All right. Fortunately for all you visitors, we are starting a new section, so we don't have to review or do anything like that. We're going to cover a little bit of what we covered last week, but he asked the question in verse 13, who is wise and understanding among you? Now, does anybody here, are you a fool? Anybody here a fool?
Sometimes. Sure.
I think most of us feel pretty good about the way we're handling our lives. Most of us feel that I think most of us would probably answer that question yes. I think I'm wise, and I think I'm understanding. But the what's that?
That wasn't the question you asked.
Well, that's the question I meant to ask.
Okay.
So we all have wisdom. We started getting it when we were in our high school years. Some of us, even before that, we learned how to work with people. We learned how to do things. But the problem in the scriptures is there's more than one kind of wisdom. There's two kinds of wisdoms. And he's going to be dealing with that here. He's going to talk about the wisdom that's from below and the wisdom that's from above. Now, the wisdom from below, you see these verses in Peter. What we got from below is an aimless conduct received by tradition from our fathers. And so there's no way when you're raised in a culture like ours that we are not going to be infected with thinking that is not appropriate thinking. And I think that's why Paul puts in Romans chapter 12 that we need to stop being conformed and start being
transformed.
So the biggest problem, I think one of the biggest hindrances to Christian growth is that we think we've reached an area where we haven't. We think that we are at a level, a good plateau, and so all the preaching doesn't puncture it because we feel like we do have a good way of handling these things. And so what James is trying to get us to understand here, and Paul does the same thing in Corinthians. Let's just look at that last verse, actually second to the last verse on page 1. It says, let no one deceive himself. If anyone among you seems to be wise in this age, let him become a what? Let him become a fool so that he can become wise. You've probably all seen the illustration of somebody who has a cup of coffee and they keep pouring and they're illustrating what can you fit into a full cup?
One full cup worth?
Yeah, you can't pour any more into a full cup. If you come into the church full, what can the Lord do for you? He can't give you anything. And unfortunately, we all have these little pockets where we think that we know how to handle these situations. But unfortunately, the way we know how to handle this situation is completely wrong, it's completely backwards. It's not what God wants. It's what we learn from mom and dad, or it's what we learn, like he said, the wisdom of this age. And it goes on to say, for the wisdom of this world is foolishness with God. Now, where we're heading with this is, I think what we see in politics today, are the Democrats and the Republicans pretty smart when it comes to conniving and coming up with ways to kind of make each other look bad? And is it a redounding to the glory of the country right now? No, right now, I keep reading, when I read some of these things, I keep thinking about what Jesus said. A house divided against itself can't stand. And a kingdom that's divided against itself can't stand. And it seems like every subject, we're 50-50. Are we about as divided as a nation could get? And so the wisdom that's being used is not a good wisdom. It's the factious wisdom that we're going to be talking about here in just a few moments. So his question then is simply, are you an individual who believes that you have wisdom? And if you are, then you have some things you need to do. So let's just skip right down to the middle of page 2. I want to try to finish all 8 pages today. So it says, let him show. I don't want an answer, James said. I don't want an answer. I don't want a yes or no answer. What do I want? In verse, or that next clause there, right in the middle of page 2. Show it. Demonstrate it. I want to see a demonstration. If everywhere you go, are there some preachers, everywhere they go, churches are divided, problems come into the church, people fall away, just issue after issue after issue. Guy's really smart, but he can't hold a church together. What would you say about a guy? Like, what's his life demonstrate? He doesn't know how to be a gospel preacher. Elders can do the same thing. Brethren, there's some brethren just split churches everywhere they go because they're so wise. But what are they wise to do? create strife, create conflict. They're looking, you know, it's like I was saying earlier, when you come into a congregation, you find out who the leaders are, and then what do you start doing? If you're wise in this world, you start undermining. What did Korah do to Moses?
Undermine.
And what was God ready to do?
Destroy his entire
family. Get away from him, I'll kill them all. I'm done with this. And after God opened the ground up and killed them, what do the people come the next day to say?
You killed.
Why did you kill the people of God? Moses and Aaron. And you're just shaking your head thinking, this is what this kind of wisdom can do. And so James wants us to understand that our conduct, we need to exhibit, we need to demonstrate by our conduct. And this is why we like to, you know, when a congregation wants to hire a preacher or when brethren come in, what do we want to find out? What's your track record? Where'd you used to attend? We kind of like to talk to the place where you used to attend. And I think with me, they wanted to talk to the last three congregations where I preached. And you're thinking, what's the matter? Have I got a bad reputation here? No, that's just wisdom, right? It's just wisdom to find out what you're dealing with, to see a demonstration. It's easy. Can everybody come in and preach a couple of good sermons and talk about what a great preacher they are? Yeah. So you need to be able to demonstrate. And so when somebody says, can you tell me three or four people that could talk about what you've been doing? If you don't have that, what does that kind of tell you? What can you demonstrate? So you're not going to be in a situation that, well, at any rate, what James is trying to say is if you want to be wise, if you want to be understanding, then demonstrate it. Virgil, did you have
anything? No, just skip over me.
It's
on a different track.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, that's all right. We can.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, we had three. The first two weren't good, so we kept going.
Oh, okay. Well, that's all right. Well, I've been here, it'll be 7 years next week. So 7 full years. We're starting our 8th year together January 1st. So I hope my demonstration has been okay. All right. I didn't want to go there. All right. So what do we have as far as, well, I'll tell you what. Let's just skip to page 3. And what I did is I just took the first 2 chapters of the book, and I said, here's the demonstrations, all right? So what kind of joy do you have when you fall into trials? What kind of wisdom do you pray for, and what have you received? And then it just keeps going. How do the poor glory in their exaltation? How do the rich glory in their humiliation? We really need to think about that latter one, because most of us are rich. How do we endure trials? What kind of a demonstration do we have when we endure temptations to sin? Our understanding of the good gifts of God. And I'm not going to read through all of these, but these are ways that James has given us to demonstrate. And so this is all part of the good behavior. And so what we need to be able to prove is that our works are done in meekness of wisdom. Now, is this the first time we've seen the word works in James?
No.
Now, what did James say in chapter 2?
Faith without works is dead.
Okay, faith without works is dead. So we've already been pretty well taught that you need to demonstrate your faith. Matter of fact, he uses the same term there, doesn't he? I will show you my faith by my works. And you will try to show me your faith without any works. How can you do that? What person in the scriptures, in Hebrews chapter 11, does God say, this person had faith without any works? They all had works. Noah demonstrated by his building of the ark, Abraham by leaving his country, and on it went. Okay, so the works are done in meekness of wisdom. Now, here's where we run into our first roadblock, because the word meekness doesn't resonate with us. We don't use the word. When's the last time you used meekness in a sentence? Telling your kids you need to be more meek. Why would you tell them that? What would you be trying to tell them if you said you need to be more meek? See, we don't use the term. And so here we have a term that is critical to our spiritual growth and development, and even the Greek translators are going to tell us there's no English word for this. This word is not found in the English language. Now, there's a word that we have, meek, but it doesn't at all mean what this word means. So let's go ahead and turn to page 4. And let's look at this. Now, this is for you later. I'm not going to take the time to do this now, but I wanted you to see in this little box on page 4 all the uses of the word meekness in the Scriptures and what you find. Now, this is the King James New King James Version. Different translations have different words. But as you look through the various words, do you see that the words are all over the map? That once it's meek, then it's gentle, then it's lowly. Then it's gentleness, then it's humility, and meekness. And as I say, now, gentle has a meaning, lowly has a meaning, but how do we combine all of this? And so let me read the definition starting on the bottom of page 4. The meaning of protes is not readily expressed in English, for the terms meekness, mildness, commonly used, suggest weakness to a greater or lesser extent. In other words, most people are meek because they have to be. The henpecked husband is meek. What does that usually mean? If he's a henpecked husband,
weak.
He's not able to stand up for himself. He's not able to handle himself. And so the meek are crushed under the strong. Because the weak can't, they're too weak to do anything about it. Well, that's not what this word means. This word is just, was Jesus too weak? Is that why he was meek?
No.
He just, there just wasn't anything he could do about it. What did he say in the garden? I can call on my Father and get what?
Legions of angels.
Legions of angels. And I keep making that point. How many angels did it take to kill those what was 150,000 Assyrians in one night?
One.
Took one angel. What would a legion of angels be able to do? If one angel can kill that many people. And so this concept of weakness, this is a fruit of strength. The stronger you are, the more meekness you will have, the more gentle you will be. And so here's Jesus, the Son of God, King of kings, Lord of lords. You know, you read his foot washing. It says at the very beginning there, he knew that the Father had given all things into his hands. He knew he had come back from, he had come forth from God, and he was going to God. Is there anything greater than that? He knew he was the Word who was with God and was God. He knew he was the Creator. He knew that he was going back to be King of kings and Lord of lords. And then in meekness, what does he do? He washes the disciples' feet. Was it because he was weak? No, it was to teach them a lesson. It was to show them the power of meekness to be helpful in certain situations. And so the second definition is mild and gentle friendliness. So this is the person who will always respond with a kind word, even if, what if it's turn the other cheek, go the second mile? What are you going to get from him? Kind word. If he's winning the game, get a kind word. If he's losing the game, still get a kind word. This is a kindness. This is not rough. This is not rude. This is a person who, we talked about this a little bit on our Sunday morning lesson about retaliation. God needs me to be a good example so that when the moment comes when that person can be converted, whether it's my worst enemy or my best friend, what can I do? I can step right in. But if I've been rude and obnoxious to that person and told him off and maybe even used some language that a Christian shouldn't use and now an opportunity to preach the gospel comes, what do I do? It's kind of embarrassing. It's like that illustration on Sunday. You know, a gospel preacher's coming to a gospel meeting. He preached first day. He gets into a little battle on the road, yelling at somebody back and forth and gesturing, and then he pulls into the same church parking lot, and it's one of the elders that he's been having this little tussle with. Well, how's that going to go? And that's the idea here. No matter what the circumstances, a meek person will always respond, you know, because they're strong enough to realize I don't have to retaliate. God's going to take care of this. I don't have to worry about it. And so it's not up to me. You know, a lot of times we get into these little situations where we have to win. And as the more we have to win, what starts to happen? We start getting ugly and rude and obnoxious. And that's not what the church needs. Brian?
Yeah, I was thinking of Moses. Wasn't it God that said Moses is the meekest man on the earth? And yeah, he did have a point where he was angry and struck the rock, but how many times did he, when God said he was going to destroy the Israelites for their sin, go on their behalf and talk to God about not doing that? And
right.
He talked about Korah's rebellion, all these different things where we see in Moses' life, he responded gently and lovingly when, you know.
Well, and that's exactly
right. We may not have
done
that if we were in his shoes, you know.
And believe it or not, that's in here. We haven't gotten to it yet, but okay. That's a point that I make, is that Moses was the meekest man in all the earth. When Miriam and Aaron started bad-mouthing Moses and saying that he wasn't worthy to be the leader because of the wife that he'd married, he doesn't stand up for himself, but what does God do?
Does it for him.
Why are you talking to my servant?
God strikes her with leprosy and says if her father had but
spit
in her face. And so how did God feel about what Miriam did? He didn't like it. She had to sit outside the camp for a week because she was a leper. And it must have been a very long 7 days. So, essentially, meekness of wisdom, I think, is characterized in this box on the middle of page 5. If you have bitter envy, in other words, the good things that are happening to your brethren are bothering you. And they're making you feel jealous, and they're making you feel that you need to do something to bring them down. You can't get up to their level, so you need to bring them down. And self-seeking has to do with factiousness. And we're going to spend a little more time on this. I'm just kind of laying it out right now. If you have any bitter envy, if there's anybody in the congregation that you feel uncomfortable, you feel that they have a reputation that you should have, or that they have a situation that you'd like to have, and this particular word envy has a good and a bad side. If I see you in a situation that I want, what can I do? I have two choices, right?
Hold them down or lift yourself.
Yeah, I can emulate you. I can say this is a goal for me. Or I can say I can never reach it, but I got to get you down on my level, so I'm going to tear you down. And so if you have either one of those, you don't have any meekness of witness. So every time you feel jealousy, and every time you're tempted to create a situation with somebody where you're going to cause a problem, he said this wisdom is not from above. It's earthly, sensual, and demonic. But then on the other side is the person who has meekness of wisdom is first pure, then peaceable, then gentle, then willing to yield, and full of mercy. And I think that's probably the best scriptural definition of meekness that we have in the Bible, is it's pure, peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, and full of mercy. So when a person has an opportunity to be peaceful, or they have an opportunity to create strife, their true wisdom is going to come out. And so this is what James is really after here. The last thing we need in the church is considered a body. We'll get to this in just a few moments. But in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, Paul says that God created the body in such a way that even though certain parts of the body have tremendous abilities, much greater than other parts of the body, and yet, does the body ever have jealousy? Jealousy issues? Does the foot ever say, man, I'm taking you out, brain? I'm sick and tired of you running the show. I want to run the show. So here's the foot sitting on top of my head running the show. I don't think anybody would be happy in a situation like that. But does that happen in the church sometimes? Does the foot say, I'm going to take out the head? Look at the Pharisees. What did they say about Jesus? What did Pilate see? For envy, they delivered him up. Now, that's the exact same word as here. This is the same bitter envy. Those people didn't like Jesus, and yet, were they in the position to run God's kingdom? They weren't. Jesus was the only one who could be head over all things to the church. And we should be thrilled that he's there. Nobody should feel any jealousy toward Jesus. If you feel jealousy toward the Lord, and let's face it, do a lot of people feel that way even today? I mean, they must, because look at how they're treating him. They don't like the authority that he has, and so they bring him down. And they bring him down just like Korah brought Moses down. And so we have this problem, and so we start down in verse 14 there at the bottom of page 5, and we want to talk a little more about this bitter envy. Let's go ahead and turn to page 6. And again, you know, this particular class is just full of information, you know, really good information. It's written so that people who want to teach this class someday will be able to do that. But I don't want to spend the time getting down into all these details, or we're never going to finish the book. So, but I would highly recommend that you read this passage about God wanting the fact that if one member suffers, look at verse 26. If one member suffers, all the members are suffering. There isn't one going, oh, I'm so glad that happened. I am so glad that guy needed that. That's what he needed. That's going to give me the opening I've been looking for. Is that the wisdom from above? No, that's an earthly, devilish, demonic wisdom that we don't want. If one member is honored, all the members rejoice. If there should be no feelings of jealousy in a home or in the church or really in a country, we're all working. What do they say? Rising tides
lift all boats.
Lift all the boats. So if good things are coming, are there a lot of people today who hope that Trump's going to fail, that something bad's going to happen? And so they can point to, yeah, there's a lot of people out there like that. Are there people, on the other hand, hoping the Democrats are going to do the same thing? Yeah, there's just a bitter hatred, and it's just so sad to see that people would rather have terrible things happening than have somebody looking good that they don't like. And it's just a serious, serious wisdom. We don't need it in the church. It's in the world. I mean, let's face it, it's in the world. You just go to a football game, and you watch the opposing, you know, one guy's got this jersey on, another guy's got this jersey on, and how do they treat each other sometimes? See, the rivalries can get terrible, and terrible things can happen. All right, so bitter jealousy and faction are two things that destroy the very, as I put here, they rip the very fabric of the purpose of the church. When somebody who is self-seeking and filled with bitter envy enters the church, the exact opposite of what should be happening will begin. And so we have to identify this. Because really, where should this stop? This should never come into the light of day. I mean, we may embarrassed think these things, but do we ever want anybody to know we thought them? But then there are some people out there who don't even care that people know they thought them. They're actively electioneering to make sure that what they want is going to happen. Now, the term zealous, from which we get the word zeal and we get the word jealousy and we get the word envy, is actually what they call it. I won't give you the Greek definition, but it's a middle word, which means it can go either way. It's a term that can have one of two meanings. This is a very good word and a very bad word. So let me read you a little bit of this definition on the middle of page 6. It says, being used sometimes is good, and then he gives you the verses, and sometimes an inscription and scripture oftener in an evil sense. So James 3:14, which is where we are, in which last place, to make quite clear what zealous is meant, it is qualified with the addition of pikros, which is the word bitter. So He makes sure that nobody. But let me just read a little bit of this. When zealous is taken good part, it signifies the honorable emulation with the consequent imitation of that which presents itself to the mind's eye as excellent. By Aristotle, zealous is employed exclusively in this nobler sense, as that active emulation which grieves not that another has the good, but that itself has it not, and which, not pausing here, seeks to supply the deficiencies which it finds in itself. Now, that's what Jesus is supposed to do. When I see Jesus, I feel a great hole because he's so much greater than me. But what does that make me feel? Does it make me feel like I want to bring him down, or does it make me feel that I need to get busy and get myself up there? And that's the difference. And that's a big difference between these different kinds of people. but then it goes the other way. It says, but it's too easy for this zeal and honorable rivalry to degenerate into a meaner passion. All right, and then it goes on, you see that last bolded section there, may assume two shapes, either that of a desire to make war upon the good which it beholds in another, and thus to trouble that good and make it less. Therefore we find zealous and eris, which is strife, continually joined together. And then he gives all the verses where it's joined together. Or where there is not vigor and energy enough to attempt the making of it less. In other words, I'm not going to fight this, but if I ever have to say anything, I'm just going to be constantly tearing down, constantly tearing down. I can't see any good in that person. I can't see anything good that they're doing. And so right now, the Democrats, can they see anything good in the Republicans? Not a bit. How about the Republicans? Can they see anything good in the Democrats? Is that really true, though? Are the Democrats not doing anything good? I guess it depends on whether you're a Republican or not, right? Well, they're doing good things. They're doing bad things. How about the Republicans? They doing good things? Yeah, they doing bad things. I mean, there's a mix. And so what we have to do is find the weak things and try to build those up and find the strong things and try to emulate them. But not, we don't want to throw everything out. And so, and then I have this passage here with Korah, where, look at verse 3 there, they gathered together against Moses and Aaron and said to them, you take too much on yourselves, for all the congregation is holy. So this authority that Moses had and Aaron had that God gave them, how did Korah feel about it?
Take it for yourself.
Of course, you got to realize what had just happened. They were wanting to go into the promised land. Those 10 spies came back and said, and now what has God said?
You're not going in.
You're never going in. So how do the people feel about that? See, they're putting it all on Moses and Aaron. This isn't God. You know, it's a funny thing about people. They won't strike out at God. They'll strike out at his followers. You can't really touch God. You can't do anything to God. But you can sure make his followers' lives miserable. And isn't that what they did to Jeremiah?
Yep.
They just made his life absolutely miserable. And so that's again, that very last verse on the bottom of page 6, he knew that the chief priests had handed him over because of envy. And this Greek word for bitterness is an interesting word. I won't read all of it because I don't think it's crucial, but just look at the first part there. It says it originally meant sharp. So it was an arrow. When an arrow pricked your body, that was picros. And then penetrating, then painful to the feelings, bitter to the tastes. The sense of bitterness yields such transferred senses as unpleasant, unexpected, painful, severe, cruel, stern, embittered. So this is not a good word. This is a word the Greeks, if something was really, really bad, they would use this word. And so this is a really, 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 really bad envy. And like I said, it's a wisdom. I mean, these people are putting it into the art. There's the art of destroying your opponent. Brian?
So does this have like a time element? Because I've always kind of thought like bitter means somebody that's bitter for years with somebody else. It just seems like it builds up over time, or is that not part of this word?
No, that's really not. I mean, if an arrow shot at you, how long does that take to penetrate?
It's like a bitter, harsh envy. Is that what it means by bitter? It's like,
yeah,
really
it
harsh.
Is a harsh, terrible, cruel, awful envy. Well, I hate to use the word envy because it's really the word zeal. There's two kinds of zeal. There's the zeal that makes me want to come up to you, and there's the zeal that wants me to bring you down to me. And one's harsh and bitter and ugly, and the other is really, really good. And so James is just identifying the bitterness here. Now, this next term, self-seeking, you can see it too is a very complicated word. That's why I have all these definitions. Whenever I put 3 or 4 definitions, what you'll have to understand is I couldn't figure it out. I read the first one. I thought, that's not enough. So I put the second one in there. But you guys are probably going, man, what's the matter with this guy? I can't figure this out. Well, yeah, you're right. If I can't figure it out, I'll keep looking at definitions. If I like the definition, I'll put it in here. But if it doesn't give me everything I want, I'll keep looking. And so this one, I went from Thayer to Vines. And then I think, where did I go last? Was it Kittle or was it Trench? Let's see. No, actually, it's Exegetical Dictionary. So let's just, and you can look at the bolded sections. The first use of it is used of those who electioneer for office, courting popular applause by trickery and low arts. Now, does that pretty well cover our our elections today?
Yeah,
I'd say that pretty well covers it. Then the next definition, it denotes ambition, self-seeking, rivalry, self-will being an underlying idea of the word. Hence, it denotes party making. So if I can't get what I want in this congregation, I'm going to divide the congregation and conquer. So I'll start with one, and then I'll pick another one, and I'll pick another one. And, you know, it's hard for those of us who love the Lord when somebody's doing this and people say they're doing it. What do we usually think? Oh, nobody would do that. There's no way they could be doing that. And so, but if you leave it alone, it just starts to fester. And so, but the last definition there, the one at the very bottom in Philippians 1:17, the proclaimers who are determined by self-interest are contrasted to those whose motivation is love. Now, you remember what he's talking about there? Paul said, some are preaching Christ out of faction, hoping to what?
Add affliction to my bonds.
Hoping to add afflictions to my bonds. Others are preaching Christ out of love, knowing that I want everyone to hear the gospel, even if it does cost me my life. But what are some people preaching the gospel for? They don't love the gospel. They don't believe the gospel. What are they doing? They're trying to destroy Paul. They're trying to divide and conquer. If we can get rid of Paul, that's going to make it that much easier to destroy Christianity. So we'll pretend to be Christians until we can get him taken out of the way. Then we can start working on these lower people. And, of course, that's how Catholicism got the big boost that it got. Because what happened to all the devout, godly people there toward the end of the first century? They were all taken out. Once they were gone, the church was very malleable, and they could modify the church and make it into what they wanted to do, which is exactly what they did. All right, let's go ahead and turn to the last page. Aren't you guys proud of me? I used to not be able to get through four pages. Now I can get through eight. You can pat me on the back here. All right. This one is probably the worst one, is this one in John 11. The chief priests, therefore, and the Pharisees gathered a council and said, what do we, for this man doeth many signs? If we let him thus alone, all men will believe on him, and the Romans will come and take away our place and our nation. But a certain one of them, Caiaphas, being high priest that year, and said unto them, you know nothing at all, nor do you take an account that it is expedient for you that one man should die for the people, and the whole nation perish not. What are they saying here? In order to get our way, it would be better for this guy to die. Now, what kind of a person would think like that? What kind of a person would say, you know, if that person's dead, I can get all of this? I can't even conceive of that kind of thinking. Because that one person we're thinking about, he's got just as much right to live as I do. And for me to think that he should die so I could get something, what kind of person does that make me? See, that's the most despicable person I can imagine, is somebody who would prefer that someone else has to be in pain or suffer or die so that I can get what I want. And yet, are there a lot of people with that kind of wisdom out there? Yeah. Unfortunately, the whole world's full of them. We would need police if the way I feel about things was the way everybody felt like. You wouldn't have that. We don't covet what other people have. We don't want what they have. That's theirs. I don't want what they want. I don't want what they have. If I do, what does that make me? Covetous. What does God say about covetous people? Thou shalt not covet. Covetousness is a terrible, terrible. That's what these people had. That's what Pilate could see. Pilate could see it was for envy. And yet, before he could undermine them, what had they already done? They'd already stirred up the people. See, they knew this was coming. And they knew what Pilate was going to do. I mean, this is all a chess game for them. We're going to do this. He's going to do this. We're going to do this. He's going to do this. And we're going to checkmate. And before it was all done, what's he doing? Washing his hands. Why is he washing his hands? He can't prevail. He can't win. If he goes any further, he'll lose his life. That's how they painted him right into a corner. And he didn't have the courage or the intestinal fortitude or the wisdom to be able to stand up to that. In spite of what his wife wrote him, and in spite of what he could see, he couldn't handle them, because these people were wise. And boy, they were smart. And I'm sure they went home that night, and we did it. We pulled this off. They were probably rejoicing. It's interesting, in chapter 5, after the church is growing and growing and growing, what does it say again? The chief priest filled with envy. Well, yeah, but it's the same Greek word. Even though it says indignation, it's the same Greek word zealous, which is why, again, it's so hard sometimes for an English-speaking person to follow the thread of some of these words, because the translators are constantly putting different words in there. So what we have here is we have people who are wise in bringing about division. They're wise in bringing about hurting other people and getting ahead, walking on other people to get there. And you and I, hopefully there's no one in this room with that kind of wisdom. And if you have that kind of wisdom, what does Paul counsel you? You better become a fool so that you can become wise. Because that is an earthly, demonic, sensual wisdom that will bring about the destruction of churches. And yet, it's all over the world. You know, I'm watching this in Malawi right now. In Malawi, the churches there in the central region, they're all getting along with each other. And you got this one group of people who want to come in, and they want to divide and conquer, and they want to bring the whole church into their way of thinking. And I keep thinking to myself, why would they want to do that? Why can't they be content? They got the north, they got the south. Why do they have to come in and keep conniving and twisting and conniving? Why are they doing that? Well, it's right here. That's their mindset. They have a wisdom that's not from above. And I don't want that. You don't want that. So this is something we all need to look at in our home. God has set the order in the home, but some people aren't happy with that. And some people are factious, even in the home, husbands and wives. Are there factious wives out there? Are there factious husbands out there who are going to use their spouse to get what they want? And the life is just miserable because the home is not a place of meekness. It's not a place of gentleness. And what were those words again? That's right. We're out of time. Pure, peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy, without partiality, without hypocrisy. That's what our home should be like. That's how husbands and wives and parents and children should be dealing with each other. And yet, what do we find sometimes in the world? It's just awful. It's just awful. There's a wisdom out there, a sensual, devilish, demonic wisdom that we need to crush out of our life if we have any of it. So, all right, well, we'll go ahead and stop there, and we'll be able to pick up next week with whatever that next verse is. I don't think I have it written down here. 14, looks like it's 14, so we'll start in verse 15. So, go home and read this thing, and I'll give you a big test next week, and we'll see how well you did. I want to know the difference between zealotes and aretheia. You can tell me all about it.